Amos has three basic parts to it. We've already taken a look at two of them. The first major part is introducing the theme of judgment, and he had that very kind of genius rhetorical introduction where he kind of sucked the people into that literary trap, if you remember what we talked about on Wednesday. And then the middle part of the book was explaining judgment. First he introduces it, then he explains it, and now in this third section, he is going to picture judgments. And what makes this a little bit tricky is he's going to talk about some strange things here, David's fallen tent. And what makes it even more difficult for us is that even though in the time period of Amos, this prophecy about David's tent, whatever that was, that prophecy has already taken place by Amos' time, so he can talk about it and the people understand it. The problem is that wasn't written down until the book of 1 and 2 Samuel was written a couple hundred years later, so that's why we haven't talked about it yet in our class. We will get to that when we get to that appropriate time period in the class. So the prophecy has been spoken but not written, so these people understand it, and that's why we have to kind of backtrack and study it so we can understand it. Hope that makes sense to you. So here's the way it goes. Amos chapter 9 says, "In that day I will restore David's fallen tent. I will repair its broken places, restore its ruins, and build it as it used to be." So one of the assumptions here, of course, is that the tent falls down. Okay, so what in the world does that mean? All right, so here we go on a little backtrack. Let's go to 2 Samuel and see if we can figure out what this fallen tent thing is all about. "When David came to rule in Jerusalem and enjoyed his palace, he looked at God's house, which was really a mobile home, and said, 'I'll build you a permanent house.'" Because David attacks Jerusalem, or attacks what was called Jebus, makes it his own, and he there has his own palace as a permanent place, but God is living in the tabernacle, not yet the temple. The tabernacle, by definition, is a mobile home. It's made out of animal skin, so you can pick it up and carry it around the desert, right? And God says, "Boy, there's just something not right about this. You ought to have a permanent home, a temple here. Let me build you a house." And God looks back at him and says, "You know what, David? The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you." Now, on just one level, you might say, well, wait a minute, David has a house. He wants to build a house for God. Why does God want to build a house for David? But as you read through, you realize it's not a house where one lives, but there's several levels of meaning here. And so, as you look at the next verse, you understand what God means when he says house. "When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom." When God says house, he's using it in a different semantic sense. He means a dynasty, a succession of a son and a grandson and a great-grandson on the throne. So God kind of answers back on a different level what David's talking about. But God says, "Well, I have a more important idea than where I'm going to live. I want to talk to you about a Davidic dynasty," which is pretty important here for this king, because, of course, his successor didn't have this, right? As you take a look at Saul, Saul was cut off and didn't have this, and becomes very, very important, of course, because Messiah is going to come through David's line. So it's important that he have a line and succession of kings on the throne. So what we have here is this promise of a Davidic dynasty. Now let's take that back to this. So if in fact this house means David's sons are reigning on the throne, or that tent, and the way it's translated here, if in fact we have a tent that is fallen and is going to be broken, then the timeline or the imagery that we're setting out here in Amos is that around 1000 B.C., during David's reign, or when David dies and Solomon begins to reign in his stead, his sons are reigning. In 586, this is when the tent falls down, as it were. Because if you remember, we use this... let's see if I can get my pointer working here. We use this the walkthrough to talk about how Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and took away the last Davidic king, carried everybody over here to Babylon, where they stayed for 70 years. And at the end of that time, God raised up two leaders. Remember, the first one was, Priestly. His name was Joshua. The second one was Royal. His name was Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel came back and rebuilt the temple out of all the rubble. Yeah, at least you remember the important parts here. But the reason why I tried to say Zerubbabel was royal, I didn't want to say he was king, because even though he had royal blood flowing through his veins, he doesn't actually get to be king. That's because the Greeks and the Persians who are in control don't want Israel to be politically independent. Now, Israel, as they are moving back along the way, I'm being a little bit facetious here, but as they're moving back, they're thinking, oh, we're going to go back, we're going to live in our land, and we're going to have a king, it's going to be just like it was before, and we know who the king's going to be, right? It's got to be Zerubbabel, because he is the next in line. So they get back here, and everybody wants to be Zerubbabel's friend, you know, they want to be the first buddy, as it were. But the trouble is, the Greeks and Persians don't let Zerubbabel rule. They are not politically independent. So when Zerubbabel dies, then everybody wants to be Zerubbabel's son's best friend because they think he'll be king. But then he dies, and so everybody wants to be Zerubbabel's grandson's best friend. But eventually, for generations, people kind of get disillusioned and say, well, boy, we're never really going to reign, and nobody wants to be the friend of the descendant of Zerubbabel. Until the point where generation after generation after generation comes, and you got a guy who is simply acting like a carpenter who lives in Nazareth, who in reality could have the right, the legal right to sit on the throne, but everybody's kind of given up on the hope of being politically independent and him actually being king. So Joseph, who is the heir to the throne, is just a carpenter in Nazareth. Okay, and that's because the tent falls down, that is, David's sons no longer reign on the throne. And for a long time, people get discouraged. Obviously, even into Jesus' day, people are discouraged and think the tent is never going to come back up. But this prophecy is here to say that someday the tent will be raised back up when the Son of David reigns. And in many ways, as you look at this timeline, we're still up to here, but not over here. We are in a place where Israel is not, or at least doesn't have a Davidic son reigning on the throne, and hadn't been politically independent for a long, long time. All right? So, this is a huge, major messianic promise. In fact, one of the things I should have mentioned to you was, whenever you see the prophets use the phrase, in that day, it is a reference to messianic times, in the same way we would say once upon a time. You know, when someone says once upon a time, it's a literary indicator that we have, you know, a fairy tale coming. When the prophets say in that day, they're talking about messianic times. So, even though David's sons are not going to reign for a time, they eventually will when the Son of David, the Messiah, comes. Now, this is particularly troublesome in David's day, because, you know, if you back this thing up to David's day, the tent is still in good condition. You know, it's like saying, you know, I'm a doctor and I can heal your broken arm, Sarah. And you say, my arm's not broken. I said, well, not yet, but it's going to be. And that's what's happening here. We're going to raise that fallen tent. Everybody's saying, well, there's, you know, the tent's not down now. Yeah, but it's going to be. But even when it does, God's going to raise it back up. Okay? Any questions about this discussion? Or are you with me on this fallen tent thing? Okay. All right. Let's go on and let me talk to you about this then. One more statement of promise here at the end of the book. And it says, it started out, introduced by the phrase, the days are coming. Days are coming, or in that day, again, both of those ways in which the prophets describe messianic times. Days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman, and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from the hills. Talking about when Messiah comes back. Now, if you were a farmer, and almost everybody was in Amos's time, and you were to read this verse, you would look at that and say, oh, wow, that is so cool. That is great. I can't believe that. You and I look at it because we're not farmers, most of us, and think, what's the big deal? Right? Well, let me explain to you how a farmer would read this, okay? If you take a look at kind of a farming calendar, when does harvest or when does reaping take place? You know, this, you don't have to be a farmer, you just have to live in the cornfields to know this.
October.
Yeah, October, pretty much right in here. And if you have a really good harvest, you know, it takes people like 3 or 4 weeks to get everything in. Okay, and then it's over and you carve your pumpkins and you go in for the wintertime. When do you plow things? When does the plowman come around? In order to plant for the spring, you plow, yeah, generally in April, something like that, okay? When the plowers work. Now, what this is saying is that the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman. That is, the reapers will be so busy and have to work so hard that they will still be in the fields when the plowmen start coming through and say, hey, can't you guys hurry up? You with me here? So that what it's talking about here is a messianic harvest that goes all the way into April. Now, this is a little bit exaggerated, because frankly, if you had a harvest that was so big that it took you all the way to April to get it, no one would say, you know, hurry, we got to plow, we're not going to have food. You know, no one would care. If you had that much food, no one would care anymore. Okay, so it's exaggerated a little bit to make the point that when Messiah comes back, the curse is going to be reversed, and you're going to have so much food, you're not going to know what to do with it. Now, it's not just that you have a lot of food, but the point is, if it only takes you like 2% of your time to get enough food, what can you spend the rest of your time on? Lots more fun stuff, wherever you want to do, right? I mean, one of the things that I lament a little bit about right now is that I spend almost all my time just trying to keep my head above water, my nose above water financially, you know what I mean? I mean, it's not like I'm poor, but you get a job and you get this big paycheck and you think, oh, that's neat, I got a big paycheck, I just got a job. But then you realize, oh, I also have a spouse, I also have kids, I have to pay for food for the kids, and then I have to pay for those athletic shoes for the kids, and you know, after it's all over, you realize you don't have a whole lot left over. You spend a lot of your time just trying to keep your head above water financially. And God says, when Messiah comes back, you don't have to worry about that. You're going to have all these, you know, the food and all this stuff taken care of. We're going to spend our time on what really matters, what we really want to, and it's not going to be just trying to eke out a living anymore. That's kind of a metaphor that's meant for farmers, and I realize it may not get you, okay? Let me see if I can translate it for students. In that day, if we were going to have a school then, in that day, all you have to do to get an A is come to class. No papers you have to write, no tests you have to take. Good thing? Oh yeah. No way, I'll make it even better, okay? In that day, you don't even have to actually come to class, you just have to think about coming to class. You raise your head up off the pillow and say, I'm thinking, and that's enough, and then you get credit, okay? That's Amos translated into the academic from the agrarian realm. So you say, yeah, I think I could live that way. That's cool. I wanna be there. Okay. So good news is coming, even though there's some bad news ahead with the exile. Here's another verse I want you to see, just so you see the kinds of terms and the way they speak. I'll bring back my exiled people, Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They'll make gardens and eat their fruit. And I will, and notice the yellow words here, I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land. I just mention that because a lot of prophets pick up on this language, like Israel's a plant and God's going to rip them out of the soil, take them into exile. But someday he will take them and plant them back in the land for good. All right? So there's Amos. Any questions about Amos, or shall we move on to Hosea? Yes, sir.
So you said that God was planning to go back on land, like how it is today, how Israel is in, the people of Israel are in Israel, and they're going to stay there no matter what anyone says?
Good question. And the answer is kind of. When we talk about Israel, God planting Israel back in the land, is that like Israel's planted back in the land today? And a lot of people think that it is, and I think this is maybe a portent or a foreshadowing, but this is not the ultimate one. Because all the Old Testament scriptures talk about when God puts Israel back in the land, she's going to be back in the land where there is no curse on the ground and where Israel lives securely. And if you go to Israel, there's a lot of curse still left on the ground, and Israel's not living securely. Okay. Yeah.
Do we have a date for when this was written? You were talking about it was written like in the context of
2
Samuel and all of that. Is there a date for it?
For Amos?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm thinking 9th century. Don't we have that in the introduction? Did we talk about a date there? That's Hosea. It's before 2 Samuel. It's before 722. We know that because the 10 northern tribes haven't been taken away. Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, let me move on to Hosea. Let me do this. I have a friend who thinks that students should never see this because you don't really know this is PowerPoint, and you know, we want you to think that this is some sort of magic. Okay. Hosea, I've entitled, Looking for the Lover of My Soul. And there are two things I want you to get from Hosea. The first one is the theology. We're going to lay out here in fairly specific way the theology and the future of the nation of Israel over the exile period and the return period and the messianic period. And that's important because the rest of the prophets build on what Hosea says here. So you've got to get the theology if you want to understand the rest of the prophets, okay? So stay with me on that. But the second thing is, I don't want you to miss the heart of the book. This is there is heart, there is soul in this book, there is depth of emotion in this book, and that's part of the reason why God designs the book and writes the book in the way he does, so you can connect with it, not just on an intellectual level, but on a heart, emotional level too. For example, let me ask you this question. How many people here, and you need to be real honest with me and real transparent, okay? How many people here have been in a relationship with a guy or girl and you were the one, the thing broke up, and you were the one who was dropped? It wasn't your choice, but the other person decided to end the relationship and you were the droppy, not the dropper. Come on, let me see the hands. Okay, that's good. A bunch of honest people here. All right, so now, with the hands still, you know, at least mentally held up, how many of you, when you got dropped, were dropped because the other person went for somebody else instead of you? Okay. Hold on. And frankly, that person wasn't as good as you. Right? Yeah. I've been there too. And I think, what in the world was she thinking? You know, she dropped me for this guy. He's just a loser. What? This is and then all that what was just hurt sort of becomes anger, and you get this whole range of emotions you never thought were possible humanly. And if that has never happened to you, it needs to happen to you at least once, just once, so you can understand a little bit of how this feeling is. Now, if you understand that, then you can understand a little bit of what's going on in Hosea here. Seriously, because God takes his relationship with us and says, let me see, how can I communicate this to them so they really get it? I know, I'll take a husband-wife, a male-female romantic relationship, and explain my relationship with them in terms of that, where we feel deeply and strongly and we get it, and say, you know what? When you leave me for somebody else who isn't as good as I am, this is how I feel. And there's a lot of heart here. There's a lot of romance language because we can connect with that. And God says, yeah, take that and then connect it with me. Now, I don't know if anybody here has read The Sacred Romance by John Eldridge or not. I say here, you probably should. John Eldridge is known for some of his books like Journey of Desire or Wild at Heart, and he's written some others. But this is one of the very first books he wrote. And it's not like lightning struck when I read The Sacred Romance, but it changed my thinking profoundly about my relationship with God, about my personal relationship with God. I began to think about God wooing me and loving me as a lover does. And it became much more personal. And the thing that kind of shocked me and chagrined me was, as I read through, I said, you know, he's absolutely right. The scriptures are filled with this. Hosea and this love story here is exactly what God is trying to say. You know what? I love you deeply. And I want you to understand this personally. So get the theology and don't miss the heart. In the book of Hosea. Some things hard to understand. One of the hardest things to understand is how a guy could marry a woman named Gomer. He should have known, shouldn't he? Can you marry a woman named Gomer? Golly, can her? I don't know. This reminds me of Gomer Pyle. But anyway, he did know. And that's the amazing thing. God says, go marry this woman who is going to become an adulteress. But he does it anyway as this amazing statement of obedience to God and of unconditional kind of love. So here's the basic message of the book of Hosea. And I'm completely lost my head and my notes. Let me see. This page, what page are we on here? Yeah, it starts on 101, 102. I want you to be over on 103 right now with me, if you would. There's one basic message here that really is fairly simple, and it is simply bad news and then good news. And the bad news is that God will break off his relationship with the nation due to their unfaithfulness. But that's not a really big surprise to us, because frankly, Deuteronomy 28 has, you know, warned us about that, and we've kind of been expecting that ever since Deuteronomy 28. The very, you know, it talks about the exile. The very last verse is, I will disperse you and send you off into exile. So We're not real surprised by this. We didn't want it to come. We weren't hoping it wouldn't come, but it has come. So that's the bad news. But there's good news. And the good news is, but he will renew it, that is, this relationship, in the future, because of his faithfulness. You can obviously see the contrast between their unfaithfulness and God's faithfulness. And again, if you don't remember Deuteronomy 30, you might want to go back and just kind of review those first 6 verses or first 10 verses in Deuteronomy 30, because 28 and 30 are critical here, and this is the theological foundation for what a lot of the prophets are going to speak about. So, that's the bad news and the good news. Did we just lose the mic? I hate it when that happens. Dennis? I have to change batteries here. So while I do that, would you like do a little dance or entertain the troops? Sing a song or something? Better not. Better not? Okay. Okay. Testing, testing. We're back. We're good. Yeah, that's dead. Oh, wow. It's not dead. It's trying to wake you up. You want to try it?
No, it's okay.
Okay, sorry. I had to calm down today. Too much caffeine. Okay. So here we go. Bad news and then good news. Communicated 3 ways. All right? Now, the 3 different ways he communicates this basic message are interesting and fairly simple, really, through the children's names. They are Jezreel, Lo Ruhamah, and Lo Ami. Those are the names of the 3 kids that he has. And these names are very, very punny, if you will. They both have, all 3 of them, have negative and positive meanings. They have bad news and good news meanings to them. We'll explain them later, but there they are. And you don't really have to write them down because they're on that chart at the bottom of your page anyway. But they're there. Oh, man. Wasted all that ink. Okay, number 2. It's also communicated through the couple's marriage. Because there's bad news of divorce and good news of the remarriage here with Hosea and the Marine that he married. Number 3, through the nation's future. Because there is exile, bad news, and new covenant, good news. So, there it is. 3 different ways. The kids, the couple, and the nation. But it's the same message. Bad news, good news. Okay? So, that gives you some context for understanding then some of the individual verses we're going to look at here as we move through the book of Hosea. So, let's do it. And start in chapter 1, in verse 2. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, yeah, you might want to get your Bibles out because there's a couple verses that I'm just going to read. They're not up on the screen today. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, take yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness." Now, these are prophetic statements. She wasn't an adulteress or a prostitute at this point, but she was going to become that. In the same way, they didn't have kids at this point, but they were going to have kids of unfaithfulness in the future. So he tells Hosea to marry this woman who will be unfaithful to him. And so again, it's from the very beginning, it's an amazing statement of obedience on his part and of an unconditional kind of will based upon what God tells him to do. So Hosea is a really, really good man here. So he marries Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to Hosea, "Call him Jezreel." And the statement, "call him Jezreel," has to do with this valley in northern Israel. You recognize here the Sea of Galilee, and Jezreel is down in here. It's kind of an arrowhead, a funky arrowhead-shaped valley. If you zoom in on it, you can see that the farmer's fields are still very fertile farmers' fields here. And what happens is this. Jezreel, because it is this fertile field, is named after a sowing kind of a term. Because Jezreel means to scatter or to throw. In the positive sense, it means scattering seed as in planting. Because you might think of taking a corn seed and pushing it down in the soil and covering it up, and another corn seed and place it in the soil and cover it up. But in Israel, the way you would scatter or sow is you take your hand and put it in the seed bag and just throw it out like this. Okay, so this action is what they're thinking about. Now, when you're planting seed, that's a positive action. But the same action can be negative in the sense of scattering or throwing away. Right? Like if I were to take all these papers and just in one huge... No, I'm not really going to do that. Not that much caffeine. Just scatter them, you know, in anger, you could do that. So the word can have positive or negative sense here. Now, what happened here in this valley of Jezreel was a murder. God says, call him Jezreel, verse 4, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel. Jehu was a guy who wanted to be king, and so he went to the valley of Jezreel where the king of Israel was and murdered him there. And God says, you see that? That's just the kind of people you are. I mean, that one little incident is not enough to scatter the 10 northern tribes for, but that one little incident kind of typifies what you guys are like. You want something, you just go murder someone else for it, and because you're so disobedient here, I'm going to scatter you because of what the kind of behavior you've had. So to summarize it, God says, because the sin of Israel is exemplified by the murders which happened in the valley of Jezreel, God will Jezreel scatter the 10 tribes away into exile. So I'm so angry for what you did in the valley of scattering, I'm going to scatter you, is kind of the idea here. So you name the boy Jezreel, which means, at least in this sense, to scatter or to throw away, or in terms of Amos, to pluck up and get rid of. And that's the first kid's name, the negative sense. The second kid is named Lo-Ruhamah. Now, in Hebrew, the way you negativize a word is you put the prefix lo in front of it. So Ruhamah by itself means my loved one. And if you want to say not my loved one, you say Lo-Ruhamah. You with me here? So, the kids who were 13 and 14 in Hosea's day would diss their friends by saying, oh, you really look good today, Lo. Right? Okay? I want to make sure you get the idea. All right? So, when he says, okay, name this girl Lo-Ruhamah, not my loved one, because I'm not going to show my love to you, I'm going to scatter you away into exile. And then the third child is born, and the name is Lo-Ami. And again, this is a very loaded term. Let me explain to you what it means. Literally translated, it's not my people. But you have to see where it comes from. In the marriage vows in ancient Israel, they were just as well set as our marriage vows are today. Whenever you hear someone say, I take you to be my lawfully wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, you know, you immediately know, oh, that's the marriage vow. Same thing here. I will be her husband and she will be my wife was the marriage vow that everybody understood. And since it was such a powerful cultural phrase, God picks it up when he describes the covenant and says, okay, I will be their God and they will be my people. Right? So this idea of my people is a very significant one. It refers to the covenant relationship. So when God says they will not be my people, that this is a very loaded term. That is, this is an unmistakable repudiation of the covenant. So, Lo-Ami is like, okay, this covenant contract is over. I'm not going to be your God. You're not going to be my people. Because of what you've done, you're going away into exile, and the covenant, at least in Deuteronomy, or the Mosaic, or the covenant of Sinai, whatever you want to call it, this is over. So, what you've got here are the kids' names, all negatively. And that's why 1b says symbols of covenant and judgment, the negative meaning of the kids' terms. Now, let's do the positive. Because under 2b, you've got covenant renewal. So here's the good news. Bad news first, now the good news. And now what we're going to do is use all the kids' names in a positive way. So chapter 1 and verse 10, says this, yet the Israelites will be like the sand of the seashore, which can't be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they'll be called sons of the living God. And verse 11, the people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited, and they will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. So Jezreel here is used in terms of planting her back in the land. Someday I'll take her and I will plant her back in the land, in a very positive sense. And then the next verse, chapter 2, and verse 1 goes on to say, say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved one. So now he uses the word Ruhama and Ami without the lo in front of it. Okay? So someday you will be my people again, and someday you will be my loved one again, and someday I will plant you back in the land. So there you have, through the kids, the bad news and the good news. Right? You with me? Alright. Now, let's talk about the couple. Here's where things get a little bit more interesting, because when you talk about the couple, sometimes the relationship, the parallel is so close, you don't know if we're talking about God and the nation or Hosea and Gomer, which is okay because then it really communicates about your relationship with God. So here's the way this section starts out. Israel's idolatry. The verse in chapter 2, verse 2 says, rebuke your mother, rebuke her. Again, in Hebrew, this is a very loaded term, this word rebuke. It's not just, you know, verbally admonish her, but rather it's kind of a legal term, which means take her to court, bring a charge against her. We're going to take her to court, and there's a specific kind of court we're going to take her to. You know what it is? Well, the next one says, she is not my wife. It's divorce court that we're going to go to. And again, this term, she is not my wife, again, is very loaded in the culture. And the strange thing about the marriage vows and the divorce vows is this. That in ancient Israel, the way you got married was to say in front of witnesses, I'll be your husband, she'll be my wife. And the way you got divorced in Israel was to get back in front of those same witnesses and say, I will not be her husband, and she will not be my wife. So when Hosea says she is not my wife, in the language, the currency of this culture, it is an unmistakable repudiation of the marriage covenant between Hosea and Gomer. He said, no, wait, I thought God hated divorce. God does hate divorce, but he does allow it in certain times, and he allows it here, in fact commands it here, because it's a symbol of the unfaithfulness of the people and their breaking of this covenant relationship. So, he, at God's command, breaks off this relationship, which she has already broken off by her behavior, in order to make the statement. So rebuke her, rebuke your mother, she is not my wife. Now, as you move through here, you see these statements that are meant to be understood on two levels. Now, let's take a look at it, first of all, on the personal level, first of all. And then we'll take a look at it on the corporate level. Right? On the personal level, when Gomer says, I will go after my lovers who give me food and water, the meaning is fairly straightforward, right? She's going to be a prostitute, and her payment is going to be the staples of life, the food and the water. Right? That's on the individual level. But on the corporate level, when Israel says, let me go after my lovers who give me food and water, explain to me what that means. And you can't do it if you put two and two together, what we've talked about before. In what way would Israel say, let me go after my lovers?
To go after other gods so they would provide food for them.
Yeah, exactly right. That's very exactly right in general terms. Can you be more specific? Well, no, from Israel's standpoint, she's going to go after other gods who will give them food and water.
To go after Baal, who's the god of the storm?
Exactly, to go after Baal, who's the god of the storm, who gives the water, who brings the rain, who then gives the fertility and the food, right? And this was a very powerful, seductive motivation for them. And we look at that and think, oh, that's silly. But if you ever do that, just catch yourself and think, okay, am I tempted to go after money? Am I tempted in my culture to miss the calling of God in my life because I really want to have a safe, comfortable, cushy income? Right? That's the motivation for them. So they say, I will go after my lovers who will give me food and water. And We could go on with the parallels, but we won't. Let's go on to the covenant renewal here. And here's the way, here's the good news with the couple and with, in fact, the nation. God says, I will allure her and lead her into the desert, and she will sing as in the days of her youth. Now, you've got to get a little bit of the geography to understand this. Where did God first marry the nation? Where did he first enter into covenant relationship with them so that they actually got married and he moved in? Remember that language you've used before? In the wilderness, in Sinai, right? Where the covenant was first made. And what God is saying is, I will allure her and lead her into the desert, and she will sing as in the days of her youth. What he's looking to here, maybe the best way to explain it is this. Have you ever had a relationship with a girlfriend or boyfriend, and you had this big day planned or something, and he said, she said, something went wrong, and this led to another thing, and there's this huge conflict, and at the end of the day, you've just squabbled and fussed and fumed, and you say, you know, this is just stupid. Let's just pretend this day didn't happen. Let's start over again. And that's kind of the sentiment here. God says, this relationship with Israel just hasn't worked out the way we wanted to. Let's just quit. And let's start over again. Let's have a fresh beginning. Let's have a new marriage and start over again. In order to do that, he says, okay, let's go back to the beginning. And here's what's going to happen. I'm going to allure her into the desert where we first got married, and we're going to get remarried and start over again. And notice that the terms here are even, again, how do you describe the word allure? It's a romantic term. I want to allure her back and start this romance over again. Now, don't let this be missed on you. What Israel has to do is to go back to the wilderness to start over again. Does that give you any insight at all into why that fuzzy-haired, I was going to say fuzzy-haired, camel hair underwear guy who appears in the pages of the New Testament, the very first guy you see in the New Testament, namely John the Baptizer, why doesn't he go to Jerusalem to preach? Why doesn't he go to the synagogues to preach? Why does he preach where he preaches? I mean, you take a look at it. In those days came John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness, saying, repent. Why did he preach in the wilderness? Because he read Hosea. And he knows the divine plan is that they have to go back into the wilderness, into the desert, and that's where he begins to preach, trying to get the people to come back, you see? Because he knows the divine prophecy here. Now, the trouble is, of course, that in John the Baptizer's day, the people don't in mass come to him. They don't, as a nation, there is not a critical mass who agrees, and so, again, Israel doesn't start this new covenant relationship. But if you take a look at the end of the New Testament, in fact, if you get into the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 12, and then even Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus said, you know, there's going to come a day when the Antichrist comes on the scene, and when that day comes, you shouldn't even go into your house to get your coat. And pray that your flight is not on Sabbath, and you should head for the wilderness. And there's coming a time in the tribulation period when I believe that the nation of Israel will be chased into the wilderness, and they will be flat on their backs, and they will say, finally, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And eventually, they will be in the wilderness, and in fact, they will start this remarriage with God. And the words of Hosea will finally come true, and John the Baptizer will be in heaven saying, yes, finally. I tried to get them to do it before, and they wouldn't do it, but now they're going to do it. Right? So, this prophecy is, in fact, going to come true. And other parts, too. Verse 16, you'll call me my husband and not my master. Now, it seems like a fairly innocent verse on the surface, but as you see here, the word for my master is my Baal. Or, imagine a situation where you've been desperately in love with Steve. Okay, and Steve decides to break up with you. And you still love Steve, but you're going to move on. So you meet this new guy, Bob, and you have a good time with Bob, and you go out for dinner with Bob, and you say, oh, Bob, this has been a great evening, and I just really enjoyed being with you, and you just helped me forget all about the past. And I just want you to know, Steve, that Bob, that, and you know, you call the new guy by the old guy's name. This is not a good idea. Okay? You don't want to do this. That's terribly insulting for the poor new guy. And what God is saying is here, you know, in that day, you're going to call me by my right name, not by my Baal. Because they're crying out to Baal saying, oh, provide for us. And in reality, God is the one who provides for them, but they're giving Baal the credit for it. Or to use the same picture here, you go and you build this house for your spouse, and it's great, and you love your spouse, and you're there together, and you come home one day, and all the locks and doors have been changed. and you can't get in. And she or he is inside with someone else. And you say, whoa, hold on a minute here. This is wrong. They're taking everything I've given them and now thanking someone else or enjoying it with someone else. And God says, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. But in the future, you're going to call me by my right name. You're not going to call me by the wrong name. And then it says in verse 19, it will be a marriage which lasts. I will betroth you to me forever. I'll betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, and things will work out, and this will last forever, not like the first marriage, which didn't last. There's one more thing I should have mentioned, but I didn't, and that's in verse 18. It says, in that day I'll make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the creatures that move along the ground. What he's saying is that in this day, even the curse will be lifted, and the birds and the beasts of the field, the birds of the air will be affected, and the curse will be reversed. So that in this day, when he's looking for all this sort of thing, you won't have to say, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, they will not be a thing to be feared, but a thing to be enjoyed. So this will be a total renewal. So let me finish this up in chapter 2. Chapter 2 in verse 23 says this, in the future, I will plant her for myself in the land. I'll show my love to the one called not my loved one. I'll say to those not my people, you are my people. Now, read this with me in Hebrew, if you will, okay? Do your best. I think you can do it for me. I will Jezreel her for myself in the land. I will show, can you do it? Ruhama to the one called Lo Ruhama. And I will say to those called Lo Ami, you are Ami. Yeah, so now you catch it here. In chapter 2 and verse 23, we got all three of the kids' names used in their positive sense. I will plant her back in the land, and she will be Ruhama, and he will be Ami, is the idea. So you almost get things wrapped up there. You do get things wrapped up there in terms of kids. Here's the couple. In chapter 3, verses 1 to 5, the Lord said to me, go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So this is a statement, an example of absolute unconditional love, where he buys her back from the man who controls her so that he can marry her again. So I bought her, and then I told her, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will live with you. Again, those words are culturally loaded and would be the equivalent of us saying, and I shall keep myself unto you only until death do us part, which you recognize to be the statement of fidelity from the marriage vows. And that's what these are in ancient Israel. So he does go back and remarry her and takes her to himself. And then verses 4 and 5 make the application to the nation. So we can do it something like this. If you look in the upper level, Hosea and Gomer had this initial marriage, years together of unfaithfulness. Then they're divorced, spend years apart, and then they're remarried, the part we just talked about. The corresponding truth for Israel is that at Sinai, where they entered into this covenant relationship, suzerain vassal relationship we call the law, they were married. There were years together of unfaithfulness during the period of the judges. There is a divorce. 722 and 586. The covenant is broken. We're even going to see the word divorce terminology used in Jeremiah chapter 3. 586 to the present time is Israelites lived many days without king or prince. But afterward, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and there will be a reunited marriage in the future someday. And this is one of the main reasons why I think there's a future for the nation of Israel, these kind of verses.